So.
So how about that Chen Kaga film?
I just don't see any layers to it. It is it's a genre of type of film, I guess, that it's pretty standard in Asian territories. The production design, the color, the intensity of what you're seeing, the you know, kind of the taking the cliches and maybe spinning them around a bit, maybe throwing in some unusual CGI, but the inevitable flying protagonist and antagonist. I don't know. It's just a bunch of horseshit to me. I
thought it was completely soulless. I mean, yeah. Surprisingly, yeah. The artifice of it was just astounding. I mean, it didn't have any. It wasn't engaging in the least.
Right.
I didn't think. It's almost as if somebody wanted to was making an editorial about the intrusion of computers into filmmaking.
Yeah.
But I don't want to give them that much credit.
The question would be, why do you think that film has been as popular as it has been in mainland China? Isn't it one of the biggest grossing things recently?
His The Promise?
I thought it was doing huge business, or had done huge business.
I wasn't aware of that. No.
You mean it's an obscure thing that's just being seen for the first time? How about this? Why was Harvey and all these people looking to pick it up? And then there was issues about cutting it, but I heard a lot of flare-up about how popular it was over there. And in fact, I do a pen pal, I talk to some Chinese women every now and then on Skype just to, I just have a couple relationships over there, and they had talked about it, and it was kind of a big deal over there.
Oh, wow. Well, I didn't think Kaiga was ever going to work with Harvey again ever since they made him cut Farewell My Concubine.
Yeah.
I mean, that was...
I don't know.
He was really pissed off about that.
Well, he wanted to have this cut, too, I think. I think they backed out because of that.
Ah.
That was at least what I read in...
But isn't it... Oh, it's a Miramax film, isn't it?
Yeah, Disney Miramax, yeah.
Yeah, rather than...
right.
Company.
Yeah.
I still confuse the...
right.
The entities. Yeah.
So we are talking, I am talking, to the esteemed critic John Anderson, who is... co-written what I consider to be the best, I mean, I'm not just log rolling here, I consider it to be the best How to Get Your Movie Through the Distribution Mill book I have ever read, with more quotes from more people who know what they're talking about than anything I've ever read ever. Now, I'm sure, John, you must have looked at the lay of the land before you and your co-writer Laura Kim began working on this. But I imagine there have been other books like that. Were you daunted at all when you were thinking, well, let's do this? Because I'm sure other people have done it. Have they?
Well, I think people have done books about how to make independent films and about the festival scene in particular. I can think of a couple of books on that subject. But
yeah.
What we really wanted to do was kind of present the course they don't give you in film school, which is how to market your movie, which is, in this day and age,
yeah.
As important as making your movie.
Right.
And that's what we concentrate on. There's very little, except for a few comments about getting your script in order before you shoot. There's
right.
Really nothing about filmmaking in it. It's all about marketing yourself and your movie.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's really nicely written. I mean, I really like the conversational, easy to follow, colloquial way you write it, but it's extremely on top of it. It doesn't, usually when one reads a this is how you, what you need to get through the gnarly film world, it's usually half about the writer's personality, got a lot of stories. It's half about what a cool life I've lived, And the other half is maybe some good information,
Laura would agree. Neither of us have had that cool life. So.
Yeah.
Fall back on actual facts. I think the nicest thing about the book is that we managed to get to all those people. I think there's 60 or 70 sources in the book, and they're all people who know what they're talking about
right.
When it comes to independent film
distribution,
marketing, festivals,
mm-hmm.
Everybody from, James Shamus, Richard Pena,
right.
Jeff Dowd. We've got, Manola's in the book.
Yeah.
We've got critics. We've got people from all walks of film life. And
And you very conveniently list the, all the players, as you call them, at the opening of the book. And
we have to send them all a free book. That's a lot of free books.
You know, John Sloss, the head of Synetic Media.
Right.
You know, I know all these people except for maybe one or two.
You know, lawyers, people who are entertainment lawyers,
right.
Or when Rappaport, you know.
Right.
I mean, I think young people who are engrossed in making film don't realize they have to know who these people are because they're going to encounter them one way or the other.
Yeah.
Better now, to go in prepared, you know.
Now, what I, just for those who have not maybe read of the book or heard about I Wake Up Screening, screening, by the way, not screamings, but screening. There's a nice little thing written by a woman out of Tampa off Amazon. I thought I'd just quote from her for a bit. It just gives a good, concise sum up. And she writes, think of yourself running a mile-long race. You kill yourself to finish the mile, and then when you see the tape, you find out you have 4 more miles to go. That's exactly how the authors frame the problem for a filmmaker in your book, she says. You've got the money scraped together, you shot your film, you've been in post, cutting it and so on, and then, and perhaps only then, do you become aware of the millions of details and hurdles and pitfalls that lie between you, your film, and theatrical release. And that's what you guys address in a very clear cut. I love the organization, too. You know, issue by issue, chapter by chapter. I mean, it really feels like a very tight... you know, very clean book by people who've really walked the walk out there, you know.
Well, I'm glad you say that. I think it's fine to be a you know, a film artist, and I you know, capital A artist.
Yeah.
But if you want other people to see your film,
right.
You at least have to know who the people are who are going to get your film in front of other people.
Right.
If you want to I mean, you can be the all-purpose filmmaker, the one who not only produces and directs but also distributes. I mean, we both know people who have done that, some successfully, some not.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't want to worry about, you know, the more mundane aspects of all this, we at least give you the names of the people you have to know.
Right. I love the portion about Sundance, and
I hope they do.
And it's well, there, I like that story that Laura tells about how she and Jeff Gilmore were standing or riding in a car together or something and talking about how delighted they were that particular year and how much they liked American Splendor, I think it was.
Yeah, American Splendor.
And she asked him at that point if he would please not talk about it.
Yeah,
and
Laura,
if he would ask his staff not to talk about it. And go ahead, Donna. You take up from there.
Laura is very... concerned with not only the buzz around movies, but buzz kill, as she likes to call it.
Yeah.
I think she thinks as much damage can be done by, you know, over-anticipation or, you know, heightened expectations of films that, you know, to the point where no film can fulfill what an audience is expecting if it's being sold to them as the greatest thing since sliced bread. I mean, I think what we find... you and I both know at Sundance is that, you know, the programmers will get up in front of an audience and just, you know, wax poetic about the film you're about to see, and to the point where no film can then, you know, meet those expectations.
Right.
It's happened time and time again. And often, you know, oftentimes the films are not only not the greatest things in sliced bread, but they're, you know, they need sympathy, and they're not going to get it. And I think with American Splendor, Laura was absolutely right. That was one of, you know, that's one of many films that she's handled rather expertly over the years.
For what it's worth, I think that her strategy of not letting the word get around too much almost worked, at least as far as I was concerned, a little too well, because I didn't really get, I didn't really start hearing about it until after the first screening up there.
I think she had enough faith in the movie to know that it was going to, have a mini explosion.
And I also love the story about Mark Pogachevsky and Michael Lawson making sure that people did not get oversold on The Motorcycle Diaries, which obviously sells itself.
Which is, you know, the exact right strategy.
Right.
I mean, it's sort of, you know, it's like Napoleon Dynamite. I mean, that's my favorite of the moment as far as the publicizing of a movie. They position that film... in a way that everyone who saw it felt like in the theaters now that came out of Sundance 2005,
yeah.
which just somebody along the way miscalculated how to present these to an audience, and they paid the price.
Well, that's the thing. I often notice that films that I will see, as you say, maybe I saw a few in January of 2005, and here it is going into the summer season, and I'm just starting to hear about certain films that I saw a year and 3 months ago. Not that my experience matters to most people. I understand that, but I'm...
Right.
It is strange, though, to like, oh, yeah, that's right, that film I saw way back when, it's finally coming out. It just seems to me that it's almost hard to get excited about it all over again or to get yourself going again, you know, if it's...
I think we deal with this in the book.
Yeah.
It's also hard for a filmmaker and the actors to get excited about it again.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, if you discover a film now that you know, was in Sundance... in 2005, January of 2005, which is practically 2004, you know, these people have been working on the film and marketing the film and trying to publicize the film for an awfully long time.
Yeah.
And, the filmmakers have to remember that other people are discovering it for the first time, and they don't want to, betray their own exhaustion when they're trying to sell the film.
Sure.
But it's hard to do.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, with the market being what it is, it's increasingly frequent that a film, you know, will have that kind of shelf life. And,
right.
I know, and not actually hit the mainstream media. I don't consider either of us mainstream media necessarily.
Yeah.
But that's who they want a lot of times. And, by the time they get there, things kind of played out, or at least people's enthusiasm has been played out.
You know, speaking of what, you know, enthusiasm, you mentioned, like, anybody who's ever been to any of these festivals, particularly Sundance, to almost the same extent Cannes, and certainly Toronto, obviously, and Berlin, that there's a what you call a festival head syndrome, what I call a mountain air syndrome in Park City.
A lack of oxygen syndrome.
Yeah. And meaning that the way that films feel when you are watching them, and anyone who's been to a really good festival knows there is a very different chemical experience between watching a pretty good or a very good film up there with a live on the planet audience that is just into everything and gets every line and reacts in a very strong way. It's like live theater. I mean, it makes the movie seem much, much better than it does when you see it with a completely flatlined audience in Santa Ana or something at a mall,
right.
You know, and and they might appreciate it, and a few people get into it, but the energy levels don't even compare, and it's all the difference in the world. I don't know if what I'm trying to say, other than that, that when you sell your film and you figure, okay, I know what I have based on what the festival audience says, it's wonderful, and I think you love it as much as I do, I'm sure, but It is wholly a different world when you get down to sea level and get into the regular plexus. It's just not the same thing. It's a shame that it's not. I wish more people could appreciate it.
The added element to that is that when you're among an audience that has, let's say, spent the rest of its festival watching relatively mediocre films, and then they stumble upon something which is maybe not a masterpiece, maybe it's just adequate, but relatively it seems like genius work.
Mm-hmm.
And so naturally, their reaction is going to be exaggerated.
Yeah.
And then you get this, you know, and then it affects, as we've seen over the years, it affects the distributors. You know, they pick up a film with heightened expectations, and then it goes out in the real world and drops dead, you know?
Yeah.
Was my fear with Napoleon Dynamite when I saw it at Sundance a couple of years ago. I said, you know, this is, having been there enough times to know what happens, I was watching it, the crowd reaction was, the director couldn't have hoped for a better reaction.
Were you at that very first library screening?
It was at the library.
Yeah, I was there too.
Yeah, it was a Saturday night. It was a little bit later. It was maybe a 9 o'clock, 9:30 screening, as I remember, because I know it got out kind of late, and the crowd was really into it, and all I kept thinking was, man, this is going over great, but how is it going to work, you know, at the Santa Ana Mall?
Mm-hmm.
And it wound up working, but that's precisely the kind of film that could have come out and fallen on its face.
Well,
and the filmmakers, I mean, going back to the book, this is the kind of thing we try to stress. You know, you don't want to give people unrealistic expectations.
Every boomer-aged distributor or representative that I talked to after that, I think you know what I'm going to say, they all kind of went, yeah, you know, they really did. I mean, it was almost to the last person. Or they were respectful. I wouldn't say that they thought it was shit, but they didn't see it as a as any kind of second or third coming.
I don't want to pat myself on the back, but I thought it was hilarious, and I thought it was, you know, handled properly. It was going to do really well.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell right away. It had that Wes Anderson feeling to it, and I just thought, well, if this is going to go, it's not going to go with the boomers. It's going to go with the under 40s, the under 35s.
Yeah, absolutely, and they got it to them. In a masterfully handled way, I thought.
Yeah.
You know, just by letting it, because if they had opened it in 2,500 theaters, it would have had the reverse reaction, I think.
Yeah.
They just leaked it out, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, and it worked great, especially considering, you know, the movie was made for about $14.95.
Right. It's funny, that was like a the big thing that kind of sold everybody on the idea that Peter Rice and Searchlight is a great place to have your film released by.
Uh-huh.
And the odd thing was, the following year after that film came out, they had one movie or something, that Russian thing, but they just like stopped, you know? I mean, like what happened to Fox Searchlight? They just stopped. Now they're back in it, but you know what that it was about? I never actually asked anybody, and not that this is something of interest to people listening to this, but you know what I'm talking about? They just seemed to stop doing things all of a sudden.
I didn't give it much thought at the time, but in retrospect, it's almost like they went off to spend their Napoleon Dynamite money.
Yeah.
now they're back, they need some more.
Right. It's funny, when you're in a position like mine and you're selling ad space to different distributors, you can just feel when they're feeling flush, you know, like Lionsgate, you know.
Right.
You can just feel it, you know. It's not hard to talk about this rate or that rate, or you know, like, can we do something? It's oh yeah, okay, you know.
Yeah, sure. You know, whatever you want. And yeah. then they tighten their belt.
Yeah, they all contract after Oscar season, actually. You know, well, the organization of this, again, as I have already stated, is it's the kind of book that, to its credit, you can read through, and it's easy to read through because, again, really good quotes by good people. But you can also, and I think everybody likes this kind of thing because everybody has our attention spans are getting shorter as we get older, or as the ozone layer, I don't know what it is, but nobody seems to be able to read very long.
It's all about empty.
But you can pick up any chapter, and it's totally engrossing. And you don't, you know.
Well, I'm glad to say it. I mean, that's what we strive for.
Yeah.
Because I don't think there's much point in producing a book, even if it's supposed to be a kind of how-to book,
yeah,
that people don't want to read, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of this stuff is written that way. You know, it's dry, it's academic, or it's just, you know, goofy.
Now, if I were the publisher of this book, I would make absolutely certain that someone is at every major festival at a table or something. This should be like made available to people that go to festivals, and you know, the industry crowd should know about it. Is that being done?
Well, we're visiting a number of festivals. San Francisco's coming up.
You're going up there
in a week or so. And,
yeah.
Seattle.
Yeah.
We'll be at Seattle. I believe we'll be doing something at the LA Film Festival.
You mean you're going to be doing media interviews? You and Laura, you're saying, or
well, we've been doing a few.
Okay.
Lisa Gibbons had us on her syndicated show. I mean, that was a coup.
That's nice.
I don't know who listens to it, but
yeah.
I'm not sure a lot of indie filmmakers are listening to Lisa Gibbons, but maybe.
Yeah. I bet she just liked the book. She must obviously read it, and she must have just liked it, right?
I hope so.
Yeah.
That was my dream, to impress Lisa Gibbons.
All right, so how do you guys work? Are you like the Maury Amsterdam and Dick Van Dyke and the Dick Van Dyke Show? You lie on the couch and Laura types, or you pace the room?
No, nothing like that.
Nothing like that?
Laura collects information and I type it up. You know, I basically composed. She did a lot of the interviews.
Right. You mean she would tape them?
She would tape them, transcribe a lot of them.
Right.
And then I would kind of structure it a little bit. And then she'd go back over what I had done and make sure I hadn't libeled anybody or tried to be too much of a wise guy.
Right.
And you know, together we got it. We got it done. We did it. Sometimes it's surprising what you can accomplish when you're under deadline pressure. We did an awful lot of work in a short amount of time, I think.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I know what her day is like over at Warner Independent Pictures.
She's the hardest working woman in show business.
She averages, you know, 14, 15 hours at least every day. I don't know how she fit this in, or how you did, for that matter.
When we were working on the book, I would email with her at what I thought would be a safe hour. She'd be in New York, let's say, and I'd be in L.A., and I'd send her an email figuring I'd get a response the next day, and I got a response in 5 minutes. So, you know, the woman never sleeps.
Yeah.
I hope Warner Independent appreciates it.
Now, she's I respect her a lot because she's a very candid person. You don't ever get the feeling that you're being spun by her. I mean, and she, you know, is almost obliged to do that, being a person representing the interests of various films, first with NPRM and now with Warner Independent.
Right, but as you and I both know, that makes her someone you can trust.
I mean,
if she told me, you know, in years past, if she had said, you've got to see this movie, I would go see the movie.
Right.
So those are the kind of people that filmmakers want on their team.
Yeah.
And there are a number of people like that in the business. And there are others that, you know, try to sell you on every single project. And you just know that, they're not all that good. But if Laura were to come to you and say, you'd go see it.
Right. I did enjoy, I have to say, the little story about yourself and Jeff Hill and...
That's been stewing. That's been festive.
Wait a minute, now I forgot. Oh, Ed Burns, that's right.
Ed Burns.
Now, the story, just for those who haven't read the book, is basically John was seeing, speaking to Ed Burns, I believe it was. Which festival was it? Was it Cannes or Sundance?
It was Sundance.
Okay.
And it was when the Brothers McMullen was there.
Right. And that was back in 95, I believe.
And it really wasn't Ed Burns' fault, and it really wasn't Jeff Hill's fault. I mean, they were all, you know, they were doing their jobs.
Right.
But it was a situation where I had set up an interview with him well before the festival, well before the buzz had begun.
Yeah.
Because he, you know, he was from Long Island, and I was working for Newsday, and Newsday was predominantly a Long Island newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the day of the interview came, and they were like, oh, we're really busy. Can we do this when we get back to New York? And me, being a good guy, said, sure, you know, we'll do it back in New York, because deadlines being what they are, I wasn't going to be able to publish the interview before then anyway. But then the film goes on to win the festival. It was Tommy Rothman. Who was that? Who was he with at the time?
I think your story said he was with Fox Searchlight at the time. Is that right?
I guess that's...
And then he moved over to regular Fox, right?
Yeah. But I think he was at Fox Searchlight. And then he said no more interviews till the film's released.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, Jeff Hill can't argue with him. Yeah. Ed Burns doesn't know anything about it, I'm sure. But I got screwed out of my head, you know. But it adversely affected my relationship with Jeff Hill for a while, because I couldn't understand why he couldn't...
I think I've learned that lesson myself, is that from my journalistic standpoint, always get the interview early. Never, ever wait, because somehow, one way or another, it always gets put off, and it's always harder later down.
Yeah, and something's going to happen. I know. It's a strike while the iron's hot. But I learned my lesson in that case, because that was a funny festival, if you remember, that Sundance Festival.
Mm.
There were all kinds of special awards. The jury was split about everything.
Right.
And Ed Burns wound up being the beneficiary of it.
Yeah. Of course, that was back in the day when the jury award meant something. Now, with Sundance, I think pretty much I discount it, because they're always off in the ether. They're always trying to help people that they feel need the support, rather than...
This year was, I mean, they're completely screwy.
Yeah.
I said a couple of years ago, the year that American Beauty won the dramatic prize and Capturing the Friedmans won the documentary prize, it was one of the few years that I could recall that the two films that really deserved to win won.
Yeah.
It almost never happens.
Right.
And for the reasons you're saying, it's political. You know, the film has distribution. The jury seem less inclined to give it a prize. They want to use the prize to help out quote-unquote deserving films.
Yeah.
The documentary jury this year was particularly bizarre, because they gave Iraq and Fragments three of the filmmaking awards. I think they gave it editing, the director's prize, the editing prize, and the cinematography prize.
Right.
All of which had been done by the director.
Mm.
And then they gave the Grand grand jury prize was something else.
Ah.
So it was like, what was your mental process on this? And the film they gave the grand jury prize to was God Grew Tired of Us. I don't know if you saw that.
Say again?
God Grew Tired of Us.
Oh, I thought that was staggering. I was really touched by that. I don't know why particularly.
The film is The Lost Boys of Sudan.
Yeah.
Which was the same film and didn't even get into Sundance. So, what goes on there sometimes is very strange.
Well, you saw the earlier one?
Oh, yeah.
How would you compare the two?
And they were... Sorry?
How would you compare the two films? Lost Boys of Sudan.
Lost Boys was a better film.
Okay.
And not just for this reason, but God Grew Tired of Us covered a lot of the same ground with some of the same, almost the same scenes, you know, of the Sudanese...
Assimilating and all that?
Men assimilating, you know, doing... You know, not knowing how a refrigerator works, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, it's amusing in a kind of patronizing way, but but you've seen it once already. You don't want to see it again.
What did you, from purely an emotional standpoint, did you find them both affecting, or was one a bit more affecting than the other?
I think the first one you see is more affecting. You know, I think it's not the filmmaker's fault necessarily, but it's when you're a viewer and you're seeing the same material again,
right,
you're just not going to have that same emotional reaction.
Yeah.
So, okay. And then there was another film, I'm digressing wildly, but Anne Makepeace, I don't know if you know her.
Yeah, I know the name.
She's done this a number of times. She has another film called Rain on a Dry Land, which was about Somalian refugees coming to the United States, which is a far superior film, but also didn't get into Sundance this year.
Mm.
So, between the juries and the selection committee, all kinds of things can happen.
Right.
And filmmakers who want to get into Sundance should be aware of this, or any festival.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of happenstance and a lot of luck and a lot of who you know, not what you know,
right,
going on with any festival selection. Mm. And I think you're well aware of that.
Yeah. Just speaking of the methodology of how you put this together, did you have to do it? You said that you had to do it very quickly. Did you delay or something like most writers do?
Procrastination is our middle name. we're both quite busy. I would never compare my own hectic schedule to Laura's.
Yeah.
But you know, it was pretty nutty, and so we did a lot of it the last minute.
Yeah.
I mean, last minute being, you know, last few months.
Yeah.
But still, it seemed like we were in a sprint, you know, rather than a marathon.
You know, with everything, with the turnaround factor, with online columns certainly, but it's just easier to compose and get things out there. Has book publishing speeded up any, to your knowledge? I mean,
they were very quick with this book.
Okay.
In fact, when they got it from us and decided they liked it as much as they did, they moved it up by, I think, about 4 or 5 months. Well, no, maybe 3 or 4 months. But it was moved up, and we didn't have much of a window for revision. I mean, I think it's pretty clean. But
right.
But it was once we handed in the manuscript, things really moved.
Yeah.
So I think the publishing industry is aware of the time lag and how they've got to react to it somehow. They keep making physical books.
I'm going to read what David Anson, the Newsweek movie critic, said. It's on the back of the book, but it says, packed with inside info, I Wake Up Screening is an invaluable and sometimes dishy Bible of do's and don'ts for indie filmmakers. Anderson and Kim have debriefed just about every major mover and shaker in the American independent world. If you want to know how to play the game, read this book. You know what I thought also was a nice choice on your publisher's part was, apart from the design, which I think is very nicely done, but they decided just to go with a trade paperback and not a hardback first, which I thought was just right. It just felt right to me that it was not...
It's the kind of book that people, you know, you can only imagine people carrying it in their back pocket or in their backpack or, in their camera bag. Or, you know, it's not a hardcover type book.
Yeah.
It's a manual, you know?
Yeah. Right.
A guerrilla filmmaking manual or film selling manual.
Yeah.
David was very nice to say that. I do like that it's a little dishy.
Yeah.
You, you, you want to have a certain intimacy with your reader and
sure.
As you said before, a conversational tone.
Yeah.
It makes people want to keep reading it, and it's why else read it.
Now, one thing I got to say, given that my thing since 99, I guess, is when I kind of stopped print altogether. Well, I didn't know altogether. I still freelance, but I mean, as far as my regular thing, is that the sense of getting good press that is constantly referred to in yours and Laura's book is always in reference to the big print people, and to read it, you really wouldn't know that there's much in the way of online columnists, online buzz, people reading stuff online. What's up with that? I mean, I always felt, you know, it's not just the Kenny Turans of the world that kind of just deter these things. I mean, it's the IndieWires, it's the David Polans, it's part of the thing, you know.
Yeah, it's true. I think we do deal to a certain degree with opportunities online for people getting their films shown and sold.
Right.
But as far as exposure online, yeah, we weren't too on top of that, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I think partly because it's such an unwieldy realm.
Yeah.
You know, how do you get a grasp on it all? I mean, it's sort of part of what the definition of the of the web world is.
Yeah.
Just vast.
You know?
It's that vastness. And it's kind of kind of antithetical to what you try to do with a book like this.
You know, someone was saying to me, I won't say the person who said it, but he was saying that he was saying that he believes that folks like, let's say like Patrick Goldstein, for instance, who I happen to read every week and like the guy personally, but people like him are the idea of your job is to deliver a tasty, dishy, well-sourced, reliable movie column once a week that runs 800 words or whatever is starting to seem like not like there's not enough output there, considering what you see normally from folks on the online side. And,
I think what print publications have yet to grasp is that what they're selling anymore is not really hard information, but attitude. And
yeah.
I think what Patrick Goldstein gives you is a particular point of view.
Right.
And I think that's the last sort of frontier of people who work in the time-delayed print medium. You know, all you can offer is what you can't get. I mean, if you want news quickly, you can't possibly compete in print.
Yeah.
But you can compete in, you know, more of the artistic presentation or you know, learned opinion, I suppose. But I think the print business has to come to grips with that, or it's going to, you know, really have outlived its usefulness and you know, exhausted its reason for being.
When did you start reading newspapers as a kid?
Pretty early on. Actually, I was talking to someone about this the other day. When I was in seventh grade, I sold newspapers at the train station in the town I lived in.
Yeah.
So for that particular year, I read every paper every day. I was very well informed.
Total junkie, yeah.
Yeah,
so
and, you know.
12 years old, okay.
This was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I was never as well informed again.
Yeah.
But papers were meatier then, and there were a lot more of them, you know.
You know what happens when you go to England, of course, where they still have something like 6 dailies or something?
Yeah.
What a feast it is to sit down with 6 dailies and an English breakfast at 8 o'clock in the morning. It takes you like an hour and a half, 2 hours at least to just speed read your way through all this stuff. What a wonderful feast that is.
At least in my experience, it's vastly better written.
And then you look at Los Angeles and you got really 2 papers.
Well, are you counting the New York Times?
Oh, well, I suppose I should, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I think you should, because I think it's the major competition for the L.A. Times.
Yeah. I was just thinking, obviously, the New York, of the L.A. Daily News.
Yeah, sure, but when you know, when I just sit back and think about it, it's like the New York Times seems to be the major competition here.
Yeah.
And the major competition for every newspaper everywhere.
Right.
It's not necessarily a healthy a healthy thing either.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't promote diversity of opinion.
Yeah, I was like you in any case. I don't know when, but it was sometime when I was 10 or 11. I mean, the idea of reading the... I used to love the New York Times. I used to love the tabs. Yeah. But the habit was absolutely implanted very early, and I think that what you do in your youth, you know, you get those habits early, those reading habits, we all are aware of that. But the reason I'm making this point is because my 17-year-old and my 16-year-old, who are pretty smart guys, and they write, and they get good grades and all that, they don't pick up a newspaper, I mean, ever.
Yeah.
And I said, guys, you know, you come on. It's part of it's fun to pick up. You know, it's not just the online thing. You know, you should.
Have they lived in L.A. all their life?
Well, Los Angeles, Tiburon, Corte Madera, and now Brookline. And it's not just them; it's their generation. They don't pick up paper.
Well, I find I relocated from New York to L.A., I read less because I used to do all the reading on the buses and trains.
Yeah.
And when you're in a car culture, you have less of that enforced reading time.
Yeah.
But also, you know, when I was a kid in New York, this is, you know, when I was very young, I remember there were at least half a dozen newspapers, if not more.
Yeah.
You know, the Post, the News, the Mirror, the Times, the Herald Tribune, the World Telegram Sun, the Journal American. There may have been even more than that.
Right.
But those, you know, there was such a, and TV, you know. TV was primitive.
I mean, except for the really brainy professional classes who are younger, obviously they must read the journal. But I just don't know what's going to happen in print in 10, 15 years. Even now, they're not being read that much, and obviously their ad revenues there's concern all around. There's nervousness at the Chicago Tribune. They just booted poor Michael Wilmington.
What happened there? Because I've been trying to actually I've been asking people: is he out?
Well, he's not out. He's been made the, I guess, the second stringer, along with a Sunday essayist and a DVD enthusiast in print.
And who is the lead critic now?
His name is, I'm sorry to be dumb here, because I just it just went out. It's a Michael. Hold on. I've got it written down here. It's going to come in a second. Phillips, Michael Phillips. But the reason I didn't sink in is because it's the same name as Julia Phillips' ex-husband, producer, and Michael Phillips. Yeah.
So,
and he's from theater. He's from theater. And, you know, they're trying to jack up the circulation, and they're afraid of seeming too boomerish, too foggish. They want to have someone who's a little, who's going to reach the average 32-year-old, the average 26-year-old, whatever, you know.
Yeah, you mean they want to appeal to the people who aren't reading them anyway.
That's the irony of the whole situation.
Yeah, they're geniuses. The Tribune Company, particularly, they really are geniuses.
Yeah.
Wilmington's one of the best informed critics in the one of the more learned critics in the country, and also a really good writer.
Yeah.
So I don't know why people think that why newspaper executives think that readers, you know, who are disappearing. Rather rapidly, have any concept of who the person is behind the words if the words are good, but who knows what they think? I don't think they really know.
Because they want people who have a smart ass attitude and are kind of like talk in a and write in a colloquial, easy to digest, not too highfalutin, not too scholastic, not too many references to Max Ophuls or
that's got nothing to do with age. I mean.
Oh.
Look around L.A., there's plenty, you know, there's plenty of critics who write, one way or the other, and it doesn't really outrageous. It's kind of pathetic. But, you know, the people who are making these decisions are all Michael Wilmington's age, you know.
Yeah.
That's the ironic part of it, too.
Yeah. Well, they're afraid, too, of being seen as out of touch and not hip enough.
I think
so
that's
they
got more to do with it than anything.
Yeah.
The old, watch your own ass philosophy of corporate America.
One of the things that made me like the Farrelly brothers. This is just a small tangent from what you just said. I talked to them once, and they were very confident. And this is what distinguishes a really, I think, a really clever and smart artist than someone who's just trying. And I was talking to those guys about their brand of humor, and I said, "Well, guys, what do you think of how would you compare yourself to the kind of humor that Ernst Lubitsch used to do?" And one of them went, "Who?" That's a confident artist. You know, they just it's a good punchline, and they knew. You know, I love guys like that. So.
Yeah, they're way too smart not to know who Lawrence Lubitsch is.
It's a shame that their Three Stooges movie seems to have gone by the wayside. I don't know what happened to that.
Yeah, who was going to be in it?
Russell Crowe. That was the thing. They had a whole article about it. We want Crowe for Moe, is what they said.
Oh, well, Russell's already had a great role on South Park, so I'm sure he could segue right into Three Stooges.
Yeah. Hey, this is not about the book, but we're about to go into Canada. Are you looking at any particular titles that have got you going? Are you going to go? Do you still do that, or what's the thing now that you're the author?
Lord's going, I'm not. I have other duties to perform.
Okay.
I'm not going to be at Canada. I think it's the second year I'm not going.
Okay.
But, it's always It's always fun to be there.
Yep.
And what's the What's the animated film that they're going to have in the lineup?
No, you're way ahead of me. I don't even know. What is that?
Maybe it's Over the Hedge.
Oh, okay, maybe, yeah.
I think possibly. I know Terry Fumo wants to, he seems intent on keeping animation in the mix there.
Also, isn't there the Linklater? Isn't there
Scanner Darkly.
Scanner Darkly, yeah.
I think that's the opening night film, isn't it?
You could be right, yeah.
I think it is. And they're also, they're having the Al Gore film, An Inconvenient Truth.
Yes.
In the official selection, although out of competition.
Yeah.
I don't think they want to put Al up against,
John Lesher told me that's a very slightly different cut over there for European
really?
Audiences.
That I didn't know. I thought it worked really well at Sundance.
Me too. Were you at that library screening when he got the standing ovation and all that?
Standing ovations when he walked in. Standing ovations when he walked out.
Yeah.
But I think the movie stands up. I think it's a hard movie to sell. You say, oh, it's Al Gore doing a global warming lecture, but
yeah.
People are guaranteed to tune out, but it really works really well, and a very emotional film.
I've got a couple of friends, one an actress that I take out as arm candy. You know, she likes to go to movies, and I couldn't get her to go. She wouldn't do it. I said, I'm telling you, really. I know what you think it's going to be, but it really, really is something you feel good about seeing. Okay. It's not boring. It is, well structured, well edited. It's informative. You come out knowing more, and she wouldn't do it. She just said, "I don't want to see that. It'll just depress me. I want to see a movie that'll engage my emotions." This does engage your emotions.
No, there's all too much resistance to the facts in this country.
That what?
There's a lot of resistance to facts in this country.
Yeah, sure. People perceive it's an economically threatening notion to talk about. Trying to save the planet.
I'm going to have to get an electric car? What?
Yeah.
I want to do that. I'm actually in the middle now of watching all these Iraq films, and there are seemingly dozens of them.
Yeah.
But you want to talk about depressing. That's.
You know what I have not seen that I'm sort of kicking myself for not is the one that was made by that poor guy that died in his mom's swimming pool right before the Spirit Awards. You know the one I'm talking about?
Yeah. But which, now I can't remember which topic.
Yeah. I thought you were going to know because you've been watching them all and I haven't been focusing on them as much.
Not Operation Dreamland, but.
I was going to say that might have been it, but maybe you're wrong.
No, but it wasn't. I could keep stammering all afternoon, but.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Right. Anyway.
I think that's evidence of how many of these films are out. It's really uncanny how many films have come out of the Iraq War so far.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most covered war by documentarians, certainly.
My thought when I first after seeing the enormously disappointing Jarhead last. October, November, whenever it was.
What did you think of Jarhead?
I thought it was a reasonably decent adaptation of the book. I knew what the book was, but yeah. I don't know. I thought they were going to do more with it. The idea of there's just no payoff,
It was a beautiful looking film. I thought the cinematography was great. But it was sort of, I really didn't understand why it was made at the end.
Yeah.
Kind why it was made, you know?
Mm. You know, have you ever seen Betty Page's little 16-millimeter porn films? The one, not porn films, but those titillation films she made in the early 50s, I believe it was?
I admit nothing. Okay. No, I haven't.
But I'm
only familiar with her stills,
yeah.
But no, are they...
Well, I'm just wondering if she was... I mean, my understanding is that the reason she did not make it in mainstream movies is she wasn't a good actress, but I just felt that Gretchen Mol's performance was she was trying to play somebody who couldn't act, right? Wasn't that the idea?
I hope so.
Yeah. Anyway.
It could be. It's like the Liza Minnelli cabaret syndrome, you know, play somebody with no talent.
Yeah.
But Gretchen Mol, she's absolutely adorable.
Yeah.
I just don't understand, you know, if we're supposed to understand what made Betty Page Betty Page, you really don't get that out of the film.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I don't think Gretchen Mol should go back to being Gretchen Mol. I think she should remain Betty Page.
It's funny.
That would be a good career move.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I'm going to, I hope then, I'm going to go up actually to the San Francisco Film Festival. I hope, so you guys are going to be in some
We're
way.
We're doing a panel book signing kind of thing.
Great. Do you know what date that's going to be?
I believe it's the 2nd of May.
Okay.
And it's a great festival, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
I look forward to going up there.
Yeah. And what other festivals or cities are you and Laura going to visit besides that?
Seattle.
All right.
I believe L.A. I know the Woodstock Festival, but that's not till the fall.
Okay.
And, you know, we don't have everything. I don't think we have all our festivals lined up yet.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think festivals are the place we should be with this book. Mm.
And the I was going to say also that... the world is just teeming with, particularly the last, as you know, the last 3, 4, 5 years, the number of people submitting films from all countries, all over the world, as with the accessibility of good high-level video cameras has really gotten large. So I would think that people in every country, if they want to try and crack this this industry here, and everybody does, everybody wants to be a player in this particular culture, in this industry, that this is an invaluable thing to read.
Your lips to the ears at Billboard Books.
What? Couldn't hear you.
I was thinking if we could just sell a copy to every film school student in the country, we'd be doing very well.
Sure, yeah. Well, I hope that happens, because I think it really should be it's much of an essential read is, I don't know, the American cinema or your ultimate film festival guidebook like the Chris Gore one. That's something that I feel I have to have a copy of. Mm-hmm. I think this is something that people really have to have a copy of. So.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. That's I'm glad to think that. I hope other people do too.
All right, man. It's very nice speaking with you, John.
You too, Jeff.
And be well and have a nice weekend.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Take care.